All right, folks, welcome to the Team VTAC podcast. I'm your host, Kyle Lamb. And today, I know exactly where we're at. Fort Benning, Georgia. And I'm here with Lieutenant Colonel Trey Lawrence. I must say that if I was going to bet, I would have said that would never happen.
Me too.
Trey,
me too.
Nice to have you.
Thank you, sir.
And then Troy Lawton. And Troy, you are. What's your position?
I'm the ballistics director, if you will, at the Army Marksmanship Unit. I'm the ammunition firearms performance combination piece. So we do a lot of testing.
So you test the pistols, the carbines, the rifles, the bolt guns, everything.
Yes, sir.
Nothing with shotguns, though.
Occasionally, mainly for function.
Okay.
Not much accuracy.
All right, so we're at the Army Marksmanship Unit, and Trey here, my buddy, has taken... I guess I'm supposed to call you sir now, right? Is that what I'm supposed to call you?
No one else does, Kyle, so it's okay.
So Trey has recently taken over the command of the Army Marksmanship Unit, so congratulations.
Thank you.
With that. They were trying to find the perfect guy. He was not available, so Trey is now here. No, man, it's awesome to come down here and see what you guys got cooking. And Troy, you come from a background of, you were in the military for how long?
About 7.5 years.
And then you shot competitively here.
Roger, sir, yep.
And you shot running bore, running target.
I did. I actually shot running bore and running target here at AMU. Shot on the U.S. team, yep, national team.
And yesterday I was asking Trey about that. He didn't even know what I was talking about. But so is running bore just not done anymore?
Or? In other countries, it's still a viable sport in those. But once it was dropped out of the Olympics, it was not something that Americans compete in anymore.
Okay. So when did that stop?
In 2004.
Okay. Yep. So you came here as a competitive shooter. And then what happened?
Well, my background had always been in ammunition and testing. Grew up hunting, shooting, and competitive shooting, actually from about the age of 9. But it was because my family did it. So it's in my DNA, literally.
Yeah.
Enjoyed being the director here of ballistics. It's been quite a ride.
Yeah, and you would think... by the year 2018, we'd kind of be done with development, but it just keeps coming and coming, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
Some of the stuff that you showed us yesterday with the machine gun bullets that actually go so far and then fall out of the air.
Sure.
Probably not quite like that, but, or is it like that? I mean, what happens with those machine gun bullets?
Just trying to... design bullets that would allow you to more training opportunities, and so to design instable flight is what you're trying to do, which is exactly the opposite of what you tend to do when you want more efficiency. You want more efficient flight, and you want less drag, but in this instance, you wanted to kind of program the drag in so that you could go out and train with your machine guns and follow your normal training regimen. And the shooter, soldier wouldn't see it, wouldn't notice. But rounds would not go max distance like standard rounds would.
So some of those had a crazy cone-shaped tip, sure. And the others had a hollow base.
Sure.
A hollow base just to get them to spin, or?
Sure, just to make them become unstable sooner.
Okay. Yep. But you said that they were the same point of aim, point of impact, out to 800 yards?
Sure.
So at what point does that get unstable?
Past 1,200.
1,200, okay. That's cool. That's just awesome, man. So, Trey, just let's hear your story. How'd you end up down here?
Well, you know, Kyle, let me back up, and I'm going to let Troy in on a secret. So I met Kyle back in 04. I was going through the Q course, and I asked a mutual friend of ours, hey, I need to get dialed in on the pistol. And he said, I know just the guy. Go to this range this weekend. He'll be out there waiting on you. So anyway, so that's where I met Kyle, and we went through a couple days, and that was the first time that I had a formal pistol training in the military. And it served me well throughout the Q course, and then once I got to fifth group, utilizing the pistol a lot more than what I did in the infantry when I first came in the military. And then, of course, Kyle has always been important in my life. And I remember, I was thinking about this morning. So I'm driving, I was in D.C. So after fifth group, I went to the Pentagon.
What song was playing on your radio when you thought of me? That's what I want to know.
It had to have been Journey. I'm sure it was something from Journey.
Journey.
But, you know, I'm leaving the Pentagon. I'm going about 70 miles an hour north on GW Parkway because my daughter's going to be born. Wow. And I'm calling Kyle. I don't know why I called Kyle, but I did. And so I'm going through traffic back and forth, and I just remember him telling me, he said, hey, you know, when you hold your first child for the first time, that will be the only time, you'll have to remember this, that you will fully realize the unconditional love God has for you, you'll have for that child.
Sure.
And I always remember that. And I tell other folks that who are about to be parents. I'm like, hey, you know, a smart man told me this one time. And so it's absolutely true. So, and then throughout, you know, after the Pentagon, and then I went back to fifth group, always tapping into Kyle's brain, trying to figure out my way in life and how I need to provide value to the organization, whichever organization I'm a part of. So, yeah, I went back to fifth group. This long way, but I wanted to throw this in, Kyle. Then I went back to D.C., and then lo and behold, somebody said, you're to report to Fort Benning. You're going to take command of the Army Marksmanship Unit. And that was only the second time I had heard of this unit. So the first time, when I went to 5th Group the first time, my troops, 1911s, just got back from AMU. And the other troops, 1911s, got tooled up from another organization. So that I knew about AMU at that point, and I understood what they could do with the weapon systems through the custom firearm shop. But I really didn't understand the breadth of what this organization does with the world class competitions.
Yeah,
and then with the ballistic testing evaluation that Troy brings to the table, it's unbelievable.
Well, I think on the regular Army side, when Merle Eddington, Jay Christie, guys like that were the first guys that started the action shooting team. I think that's correct.
Absolutely.
And I knew those guys. They would come to the matches and shoot with us. And Jay had been a former unit guy. Then he'd been a helicopter pilot. And then he came to the Army Marksmanship Unit. And that's when they really started to make headway for people to know, just because they were out with in a different venue. So they're in a venue where more normal people show up than say, a skeet match. And nothing against skeet or trap or any of that. Great competitions. It's just a little bit more uppity, I guess, so to speak, than some of the barnyard stuff that we were doing at the time. So that's when we first started to see those guys. And then, of course, Troy here, I'm going to toot your horn a little bit. Pretty much everybody in the industry knows who the heck you are, from bullet manufacturers to ammo manufacturers to guys that are developing machine guns for the military. There's a lot of stuff that you guys have done to be able to, I mean, you're the...
And they all said I had no face for radio.
Right? yeah. Okay, so... Trey, you started out as an infantry guy?
I did.
Where were you at when you first came to the military?
Of course, come down here to Fort Benning, right? Yep. Year to the day with the training, then went over to Fort Stewart, 3rd ID. And I was an infantry platoon leader and a scout platoon leader for the invasion of Iraq.
So the reason I'm actually at Fort Benning is not to see you guys. I'm here to be the guest speaker at the Infantry Leaders Basic Course. So a bunch of lieutenants.
Absolutely.
I think they're trying to get the last laugh because they tell me that they want me to do this, and at the last minute they go, oh, by the way, you got to wear a suit. So now I'm going to wear a suit. So what if you had to give those guys as an O, one piece of advice, what piece of advice would you give those guys? Because I'm going to steal that tonight when I speak.
Oh, nice.
Ooh, just one?
Maybe one or two.
I think number one, you got to go into an organization and shut your mouth. You've got to be able to assess and realize that the talent that's already there, realize you've got a value to bring to the organization. However, you've got to leverage the other talents that's in that platoon, for instance, and got to gravitate to the NCOs. that non-commissioned officer corps is, I mean, it's as it's called, the backbone of the United States Army. They've got to leverage that. And if they have the inability to listen to the experience and the tenured folks in that organization, they're going to be set up for failure.
Yeah, I was talking to some of the guys last night, and I said, the thing that I always told ROs when they came across the hall, if they were going to be working directly with me, I was a troop sergeant major, here they come as a troop commander, I'd say, let us make you successful.
Sure.
We have a pretty good team going on here, so jump on the bandwagon with us, and ultimately, I mean, you are responsible. You're the boss, so you're the man there, but we'll make you successful if you let us do our job, and then you just keep us within the boundaries of legal and ethical and all that good stuff, because sometimes we end up venturing outside a little bit there. But cool, man. Okay, so back to Troy here. So let's I'm just going to pick something out of the blue, and then you kind of go through down how that developed with AMU. So I'll let you pick if you want it to be 6.5 Creedmoor or 6.5 PRC or 300 PRC or 300 Norma Magnum or any of those cartridges. All of a sudden, you hear about this cartridge. Then what happens?
And so for AMU, it depends whether it's for us or for another organization. So frequently, we'll have an outside organization ask us to compare two things. And maybe it is 260 Remington versus 6.5 Creedmoor. Mm-hmm. It could also be 338 Lapua versus 338 Norma. Or they might ask us outright, have you shot those two things? Have you compared those in the past? Do you have any data for us that you could just show us? And so AMU doesn't like to just, you know, conjecture, throw things out. We like to show things that we've truly tested and proven and shown the results for. And so we have very good accuracy fixtures, and our custom shop is able to buy the reamers and build the chambers exactly to spec. If it needs to be more of a NATO type design chamber, or if it needs to be more of a competition chamber, we can suit those needs. But nevertheless, we have actual results that we give people. So we have done lots of combinations, just like you're asking for. So they're asking for, it's so tough to define, well, what's best? Well, what are you looking for? Yeah. You're looking for dispersion? You just want to know which one's more accurate? Because we can actually make a 30-30 very accurate. You load for it, you put good ammo in it. If it's a good barrel in the first place, you can exploit that capability.
You know, you say 30-30. It's funny. We always talk smack about the 30-30, how it just dies, and it's like shooting a water hose. And then the big rage is 300 blackout.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Exactly.
The 300 blackout is basically a 30-30. But now, since it's in a semi-auto, all of a sudden it's cool. So
sure.
300 blackout, the new 30-30. That'd be
sure.
a good. That'd be a good T-shirt.
Oh, sure.
Right
there you go. Exactly. Exactly.
So keep going with that. So all of a sudden you've made the fixtures, you've reamed the barrels, you're good to go. What's the process then for load development with these cartridges?
And so it depends what they're looking for. And so if it's just sheer accuracy, if you want to talk competition to combat, and you want to talk match grade projectiles, hollow point boat tail, lead core, standard match projectiles. Think of how many precision sniper-like systems that are exploited just because of match bullets.
Mm-hmm.
And if those bullets didn't exist, you wouldn't have those sub-minute capabilities. And so hollow point match bullets are very important. And if you use those to initially start and define the accuracy of the weapon system, then you can go on to other designs that might have more effects and capabilities. But, boy, if you baseline and say on 6.5 Creedmoor and you want to use a particular commercial-grade, match-grade bullet and say, it shoots 0.4 minute of angle, period, and we proved it at 600 and 1,000 yards, now what design bullet do you want to shoot out of it? Because we can already tell you it's a 0.4 system. And so that is kind of our process.
So some of these ammunitions, you're looking at the extended range. So say a 300 Norma, 338, or a 6.5 PRC, or something like that. So what's the parameters? Is it like a 1,200, 1,500, 2,000? At what distance are you working with that cartridge?
And so typically we test at 3, 6, and 1,000, but we can test as far as you need it.
So you're using, are you doing something like Hornady with the Doppler radar at that distance, or?
So we can. We are the U.S. Army. And we're certainly blessed with fantastic, sophisticated access to equipment that will allow you to track it till it hits the ground. And so with that access, you can learn where things are weak and where things are stable and where things aren't stable. And when you really start narrowing it down and comparing these, say, three very good designs, and so within just match-grade projectiles, just in the last 20 years, you look at all the ogive shapes that are so efficient now. You know, you think back to Alpha 191, 300 Win Mag, 190 grain, 30 cal bullets, and just simple old G1 type BCs of like a .533, you were like, what couldn't you hit?
Yeah, yeah.
Now I've got a 300 Win Mag. What can I hit? I mean, I'm not missing anything with this. Now you look at that ogive compared to 30 cal ogives now, and you're looking at 700 and 800 BCs. You're looking at 230 grain bullets with 800 G1 BCs. Like, well, now you really have no excuse for not being able to hit everything.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So.
So when I was going through Arabic language school, the first sergeant, and I want to say his name was Palmer. I might be wrong on that. And he was talking about the 338 416. And I'm like, I never heard of this. 300 Win Mag, yeah, I'd heard of it because I hunted. I did all that. And 338 416, I'm like, wow, I've never heard, you know, what is that? Well, that's a 416 Rigby case neck down to 338, which eventually became the 338 Lapua. And correct me if I get any of this wrong, but that would have been like 1990.
89 or 90. That's exactly right.
And now we've already moved beyond that. I mean, the military is about to move beyond the 338 Lapua to something other than that. Have they made up their mind what that will be yet, or are they still in the buy, try, decide phase?
I think it's been narrowed down. So I think we're still in the buy, try.
Can you tell us what we've narrowed it down to?
No.
No, I love it. No, I'm not going to tell you what it is. Okay, good. Troy's blushing right now. He looks like the neighbor's cat that just ate something from your yard.
My mother would have said the same thing.
Okay, so yesterday, Trey took me down here to talk with Troy and his group of guys. You actually have, in your office, you also have a gold medal Olympian, right?
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
When he retired from shooting, he said, I want to load ammo for these other shooters. Is that how that worked out?
That's part of it, you know. And every great organization, it's about the personnel. And so Mr. Ryder, Jack Ryder, fantastic shooter in his day. And those that competed alongside him, Lone Zwigger, Lanny Basham, you know, they're the history of this organization and the international side. And you look back to 1956, and one of the original reasons why the unit was founded was international style shooting. And, you know, why are these other countries winning these events, and why aren't we focused on this? And so it was, you know, I believe Eisenhower that made that decision. And so here we are, and he just happens to be one of those that had the skill sets, that came aboard, and phenomenal talent and extremely smart.
And he's still doing it. I mean, that's
absolutely
awesome. He's still every day helping out the shooters and part of the team.
Oh, yeah. And so there's a lot of minutiae into setting up the tooling and the dies and to get things right. And he's another one of those that it's in his DNA. He has that desire and passion and understands what it's like for a shooter to be at that point in the competition where, boy, this next one needs to be right on call.
Yeah.
Because if this one goes in the X-ring, I break the record. And so he's been there, and he understands why it needs to be as good as it needs
to be.
What
did he shoot? What was his?
He actually shot international small bore. So.
Oh, wow. That's the real
50
deal.
50-meter and 300-meter. So small bore was shot at 50 meters. So they shot standing, kneeling, and prone. And he shot 68 and 72 Olympics, yeah.
That's pretty cool. That's crazy. So Eisenhower, we're in the Patton Roundhouse.
We're in the Patton Roundhouse.
So this building was about to be demolished. It's up here by the Skeet Ranges on AMU. And this is an awesome building. It's a round building, and it's how was Patton tied to this building?
So it's my understanding, Patton, when he was here at Fort Benning, he would come out here just to shoot skeet. And he would, and of course, you know, most tangible decisions are made, you know, in the hallways or outside of the briefing rooms. And this is where he would bring his guys. Omar Bradley would be another one. Courtney Hodges, folks would just come out, gravitate to him. They would shoot skeet, come back into this building, and then they would just talk shop. And so this kind of became the impromptu officers club. For lack of a better term, for that day. And then I guess after his time, while they were filming Green Berets, actually one of the scenes as John Wayne's character was shooting shotgun, and I think you can see the towers in the distance in the movies, but it was filmed out here. But then during the filming itself, John Wayne used this as kind of his Ponderosa to get away from all the cameras and the trailers and whatnot, and he would just gravitate here.
So looking at some of the pictures, you got Eisenhower up on the wall here. I was just at his place there in Gettysburg a month ago, and he actually has a skeet field on his farm in Gettysburg as well, so that's pretty cool.
Nice.
I saw Storm and Norman Schwarzkopf on the other wall. Of course, you got John Wayne up there. You've got a picture of Patton. You got a big 6x6 elk above the... I was hoping that Patton had killed that thing, but when I read it, it said something about they had found that somewhere, and anyway, it's still a pretty good 6x6 elk up above the fireplace here, and they were about to demolish this place, and what happened there?
So it's my understanding it was going down. The son of a World War II pilot, correct me if I'm wrong, Troy.
That's correct.
Because the World War II pilots would come out here and would practice aerial gunnery using the same fundamentals that they do for skeet.
Yeah, who's the picture of, who's this over here?
Tibbetts,
yeah. Yeah, so Tibbetts from Enola Gay.
Right.
Exactly.
That's
right.
Crazy.
Yep.
Yeah, and so his son came out, and he was like, hey, how can I help? And I think with his dealings and discussions with the Army, they decided to protect this building. They renovated it, what was it, about 8 years ago?
Yes, sir. That's right.
And then put it back to its original configuration. And so we are just lucky to have it here on our footprint.
It's a beautiful building. I mean, it's really cool. Outside, it's like, okay, what is this? You go inside, this is really, really cool. And you can picture those guys hanging around.
Absolutely.
And guys like Patton, I mean, he didn't last long because he was killed
right after the war.
Yeah. Like while they were still in
and
I think he was still in Germany, right?
In Europe.
Yep. And he's buried in Lexington or Luxembourg?
Right. Luxembourg.
Yep.
Isn't that something?
Yeah.
So he had made a pretty large impact before he even went to World War II.
Yes.
You know, you think about a guy like that, when you think that he was killed there and he still has this, I mean, he's revered today.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, Eisenhower went on to be the president, so of course, you know, you talk about him a lot, but Patton was quite the character.
He was. He was, because he introduced the whole combat arms with the tanks right after World War I, what else did he do? Somebody was telling me the other day, we were whitewater rafting downtown Columbus, and of course it's man-made, you know, the rocks were placed there on a purpose so that they could have some sort of commercial value. But the guide was saying when they dove the Chattahoochee River to see how they could manipulate the currents, they found a bunch of slot machines with gold pieces in them. And I guess the story is, you know, across the river in Alabama, Phenix City used to not be as beautiful as it is today. I'll say that. So Patton here in Fort Benning got mad because that's where all the soldiers were going, and they were going to go gamble and drink and do all those things. So he instituted martial law, brought a bunch of soldiers over there. And so, you know, to retaliate, I guess they threw all the slot machines in the river. And so, I mean, it's just funny, you know, 70, 80 years after that fact, we're still finding slot machines and cars that were rolled in the river, all because of his martial law during that period of time.
So speaking of that, when I came through the airport yesterday in Columbus, there is a sign on the wall, and it says, "But she looked 18.
Oh, my gosh.
Dude, what is that about? Is there some bad stuff going on around here?
I have no idea.
Yeah, it said something about, you know, you got to make sure to check ID or something. I guess soldiers must have been getting a little frisky with some.
Unbelievable. That never happened.
Unbelievable. Okay.
Unbelievable.
All right, Troy, so you won't answer my first question, so let me see what other questions I got here. So one of the things that you talked about yesterday, and I found pretty interesting, so when I was shooting a lot of IPSC, USPSA type shooting, we actually used some molly-coated bullets. They were really nasty to deal with, but for some reason we thought that was the ticket. I doubt that it was, but whatever, we shot the crap out of them. So yesterday you talked to us about molly versus HBN, and HBN, and I didn't know this till yesterday, hexagonal boron nitride. Is that right?
There you go.
I wrote that down this morning, so I was hoping I'd get it somewhat right. And it kind of looks like you've got frost on your bullets.
It does. Looks like frozen bullets.
So is that something that you all put on, or is that something the manufacturer?
Individuals can apply it yourself. It comes in a powder form, and you can tumble it on.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yep. And so it's very easy to apply, and it's white. Does it cause cancer? Probably.
Definitely in California.
Absolutely. On the left coast, definitely. But there are definitely some advantages compared to molly. And it's like you mentioned, molly being black and being extremely fine microns of powder, both the boron and the molly are very fine. And you need it fine so that it can get into the pores of the metal and be applied by beating it. So whether the bullets are impacting upon themselves or you're using some other media to impact the substance on the substrate. So molly has been very good if you take care of your bore. If you take care of the bore of the weapon, and that could be as simple as every time you're done shooting it, you push a light oiled patch down the bore. It could be that quick of maintenance and you're fine. Molly is hygrophoric. It draws moisture. So it can rot a barrel if you're not careful.
Also, hydrophoric, that is a word I was just going to use, Dre, but he beat me to it.
I'm still trying to spell it in my head. Hydro, okay.
So molly is still a very good option if you take care of your weapon. If you don't have time to take care of it, it's not. And if you like to go back and forth between bare bullets, which is just, it's not practical for most people.
Yeah.
And so you're going to want to shoot bare bullets. You want to take bullets right out of a package and load them and shoot them. Or you want to buy factory ammo and shoot it. That's not coated, of course. And the HBN is just another. AMU is testing lubes every so many years. We gather up all the top things and we start comparing them again and seeing which one rises to the top. And so in our accuracy testing and from our fixtures, it doesn't take very long to determine whether or not it has a significant improvement.
So are you trying to make the bullet more efficient, or are you trying to make the bore be treated with the HBN?
So you would hope that you would get more barrel life.
Okay.
And so that's kind of the objective that most people would want. If I'm going to go to the trouble to do this, what benefit will it give me? Do I have to clean my barrel less? Do I get more barrel life? So heat and friction erode bores, rapid fire erodes bores, and, well, we're going to continue to shoot rapid fire, and we're going to continue to have hot barrels. So anything that can help us, we'll give it a try. In the past, coatings were not the final answer, and bare bullets tend to be the final solution. So we look at lubes, but they're not always the best answer.
But the HBN is also not tacky or anything once it's on the...
Correct. It is, it's very easy to apply. When it comes off, it doesn't get in your clothes. It doesn't get all in your hands where it's obvious. It doesn't get your firearm filthy also. So, and it doesn't build on itself. You don't see it build up in the bore. If you're one of those, it's... So some people that really get into the minutia and they get their bore scopes out and they're checking their bores, which is a whole nother arena and can cause a lot of trouble because a lot of times people just don't know what they're looking at. But you see a lot of fouling, you tend to want to get it out if you've had a loss of accuracy. If you can't, if you're trying to figure out why isn't my firearm shooting like it was, I want my accuracy back, then many times the solution is, oh, I'm going to clean it, or I'm going to JB the bore. I'm going to do something to smooth it up again, and I want to get that accuracy back. And many times you're able to achieve it for a little while. And so those particular elixirs, lubes, are a solution. I think the better solution is better barrels, better metallurgy. And so.
So what about... So speaking of metallurgy, some of these barrels, they say they're cryoed, so stress relieve them. Yep. I mean, is there, are you shooting any barrels that have like a nitride finish, or are you trying to shoot mostly bare metal barrels?
We typically shoot bare metal barrels, but we have tried all of the cryogenics, and cryogenics does work. You can look at all the tooling where you've cryogenically treated tool bits and that are high temp. They're under high stress and high heat, and they do last longer. So the wear resistance is there. In a bore and in a dynamic environment and hot environment like a firearms bore, you want to have the barrel last longer. And so machine guns nowadays are ridiculous how you can run them at full cyclic, and they still function, and bullets still go downrange with the pointy end going the correct direction.
Are they all chrome lined though?
Not always.
Not always.
Not always. So some hammer forging processes nowadays, and some of the metals are extremely hard, which is fantastic. And but from a match perspective and individuals buying barrels today and cryogenic treated barrels, that is a version and a way to get better barrel life. So it's not a bad option.
So they're all barrels are stress relieved. It's just a, that's just a different way of stress relieving. Basically, making all the molecules lay the right direction, and when it gets hot and then cools, it goes back to where it's supposed to be.
Sure.
Does that make sense?
You bet.
Okay, so we talked yesterday about the 260 and the 6.5 Creedmoor, and you had brought up some really good points yesterday, and one of them that I really didn't. Figure out yesterday was, or I didn't really think of until yesterday, was the name attached to the cartridge.
Sure.
So 260 Remington, since it's called Remington, some manufacturers would shy away from that because they don't want to produce components with somebody else's name on them, and that just really, really makes sense. But you've probably tested more 260 and 6.5 Creedmoor than most of us out there. I really like the 6.5 Creedmoor simply because I think I have one 260, but tell me the difference between those two and what you like and dislike about each one of those.
And so 260 Remington was the evolution of simply taking 308s and necking it to 6.5, and that 6.508 had been around for years. In the 60s and 70s, individuals were building 6.508s. When Remington decided to make it a Sammy cartridge, it's very good cartridge.
1997.
There you go.
Is when that came out.
There you go.
I actually looked that up because that's not that long ago.
No, absolutely not. And so it was nice because it was another one of those cartridges that was being wildcatted, and you might as well make it a Sammy cartridge, and Remington did a good job with it. But It was another one of those that you'll hear me use this example a lot of, where you're trying to take efficiency, which is a nice to have, and get effectiveness, which is a must have. Mm-hmm. And so that's what you're always looking at. Well, from that perspective, you had 308 cases, and it was very simple answer to make it into a 6.5 bore and neck these cartridges down, but it wasn't necessarily the efficient answer. It was effective, but it wasn't necessarily the efficient answer. So from a production standpoint, they were capable of making it, and everybody was capable of making it. But the 6.5 Creedmoor branding, not using that name, like we said, interesting, like Blackout. You know, everybody wants to make Blackout. It's just called 300 Blackout. But from an efficiency standpoint, Creedmoor, if you cut the neck of the cartridge off of 260 and you cut the neck of 6.5 Creedmoor off and you fill those with water, there's only about a grain difference in volume. Well, the Creedmoor case design is a more efficient design. Therefore, your ballistics are a little better, but the main ballistics efficiency comes from you don't have the intrusion of the bullet into the powder column. That's called ullage. Another term you were going to throw. Wow. I saw it written
ullage.
Down.
Ullage. Yeah, ullage. And that's so what I was going to say.
The intrusion of your bullet into your powder column. So there is a lot less, and it allows you to put the entire family of projectiles from, say, 95-grain 6.5 bullets all the way to 155-grain 6.5 bullets or 160-grain, and they don't protrude down into the powder column, and they still fit in a 2.85 overall length magazine. So that's truly an efficient design.
So what makes the 6.5 Creedmoor more efficient as a case that you talk about? Is it the angle of the cartridge? What is it?
A little bit. So there's some interior ballistics there that there is a little bit of efficiency when you bring those shoulders over, but mainly the fact that you got the projectile out of the powder column.
Okay. So how could you explain to me how you have that so that we have more of a tapered cartridge, right, with a 6.5 Creedmoor? Mm-hmm. That's a true statement, right?
A little
right?
bit.
Just a little bit. Then why do we do stuff like Ackley Improved?
So that's been the direction for years that Wildcatters, anytime they had a cartridge, you could say the same for 243. You could take 243 and say, well, I want to shoot it faster. I need another 100 feet per second because that's what I think I need. Well, then the answer is Ackley Improved. So you're able to actually either start with a brand new barrel or take an actual 243 and run an Ackley Improved reamer up into it, which will allow you to blow the shoulders out and just increase case volume. And so,
so it's not about it's about volume. It's not about the sharpness of the shoulder.
Absolutely.
Oh, okay.
Absolutely. So it's the volume that's your boiler. I mean, thank God for nitrogen. Boy, on that periodic table, that big N, if you didn't have nitrogen, we wouldn't have all these great kinetic weapons. You know. And so, a little more volume gives you a little more performance, and there are no ballistic free lunches. And that's the nature of it.
So continuing with that, so obviously you've shot both of them. We also talked about 6mm Creedmoor, and you actually let me shoot one of your Surgeon rifles yesterday. And
I don't let many people shoot my personal gun.
Yeah, that was that was kind of fun. That is one of the loudest rifles I've shot lately. But it has absolutely zero recoil. So tell me what that was that I was shooting.
You were actually shooting a 6 Creedmoor. I was testing some HBN and thought, boy, I've got Kyle here, so I'll get him behind it. Kyle will test anything.
Yeah. So it's a surge in action.
It is. And so, you know, and I actually compete on my own. And so it's like I said, shooting's in my DNA. And so I still competitively shoot, and that's one of the calibers that is popular out there in the 6mm. So 6x47, 6 Creedmoor, 243, 6 Dasher, 6 BR. These are all the cartridges that are used by precision rifle shooters.
That's isn't a 6mm Creedmoor and a 243 are almost the same, except for the SAMI specs tells you that you need a quicker twist on a 6 Creedmoor. Is that true?
Nope. Twist rate is all related to the bullets you choose. So the longer bullets need faster twist rates. So if you choose a match, say, so we'll simplify it. You've got your calculator. So
okay,
so
just a minute. I'm going to get it. Just a minute. I'll get my calculator going here. Dude, man,
I get to put Kyle to work.
Okay, no, let's hear it. Okay.
So put 0.243 times 5.
1.215.
Okay, so if you were to look at match bullets out there that are available today, just over-the-counter commercial match bullets, and you looked at their length, that is a 5 caliber and length figure that you just did. That is how you do it. And so you look at the length of the projectile, and then you will need to input that into any of these algorithms that are going to predict your twist rate or what should be an optimum twist rate based on how fast you now want to shoot that bullet. So if you wanted to shoot that, you bought a 107-grain 243 bullet, and you want 3,000 feet a second. Well, that's very easily achievable out of numerous cartridges. And so you would need at least an 8 twist with a 5 caliber and length projectile.
So I guess what I meant was
and it scales.
243, you can't buy an over-the-counter 1 in 8 or 1 in 7 point whatever twist 243.
Sure you can. Sure you can. So numerous companies already know that, oh, you're buying a 6 Creedmoor, you're an aficionado. You wouldn't just buy 6 Creedmoor just to plink, you must want precision, so you're going to want to shoot the longer bullets. So most of them offer
eight
twists.
Well, six millimeter Creedmoor,
true,
but not in 243.
So in especially older 243s, they might be 9 or 20, okay. 10 twists. You're correct, and because the ogives from the 70s are still very accurate, they're still very good hunting designs, but the industry. Sometimes they have old bullets that still work very well, and they'll keep them in their product line. But the nice thing about fast twist is it tends to work with all the bullets anyway. So in many cases, too fast a twist doesn't necessarily apply. So too many times you'll hear people say, well, that's too fast a twist. It won't shoot accurate. Well, let me tell you. Once you prove it to yourself, don't let anybody talk you out of it.
Yeah.
So go out and shoot it.
Okay, so speaking of that, the twist rate of your across-the-course guns for service rifle.
Sure.
So everybody's transitioned now. Everybody shoots 5.56, 223.
Sure.
What chambers are you putting in those guns?
So most people that shoot competitively use like 224 wild, 223 wild chambers. That's just a pretty standard design. And they use 1 in 8 twists, maybe 1 in 7.7. That's popular also.
Okay, so that's just because they're shooting those 77s or heavier bullets.
Right. Okay. And so you could do that same maneuver that you did a minute ago and do 223 times 5, and you would see what length that was in 5 calibers in length, and you would see that 77-grain bullets are a little shorter than 5 calibers in length, but they're very close. 80-grain, 90-grain projectiles, even some 75-grain projectiles are 5 calibers in length. They'll need that fast twist rate.
So the original 1 in 7, and this is an Army question, not so much an AMU question, but the original 1 in 7 twist, is it true that was done for specialty ammunitions like Tracer?
Correct.
Okay.
And that same thing would apply. If you take the Tracer out and you measure it, it's longer than a 77-grain bullet.
Hmm. Man.
Wow. Now do you know why everybody knows his name in the industry?
Yeah.
Oh, he's amazing.
He's got the big words. Definitely got the big
ullage.
I saw him practicing those. They're on 3x5 cards. He was on the back this morning. Yes.
Okay, so the next question is 6'5 PRC and 300 PRC. How did that 6'5 PRC is a 375 Ruger neck down to 6'5, correct?
Correct. It's one of their compact magnum cases.
So what we like about this 375 Ruger, at least me personally, I like it because it's less recoil.
Sure.
It's not a belted cartridge. It's pretty efficient. Seems like a good
Absolutely.
Cartridge. They did the 375 and the 416.
Yep.
So now 6.5 PRC and 300 PRC, they both are now SAMI spec cartridges. Are you seeing people like really start to dump out the brass for that, or is it kind of a slow process?
And so it's a slow process. And so, you know, Hornady introduced that, and that's going to be popular. And all of, as far as industry and commercial, it's all about numbers. So if you don't have the ammunition, they're not going to build the guns. So will there be more brass available later in 6.5 PRC from other sources? It will more than likely take the path as 6.5 Creedmoor did, whereas, you know, dial back to when 6.5 Creedmoor was first announced, there was only one manufacturer making the brass, mm-hmm. and now you've got six manufacturers making the
Every
brass.
Every person I talk to is like, you use a 6.5 Creedmoor to hunt. What do you think? Well, it's my favorite right now. I was telling you yesterday I shot an elk with a 6mm Creedmoor last year, and the only reason that kind of makes sense to me is because you've had a lot of kids that have killed elk with 80, 90 grain bullets out of a 243.
Sure.
So why wouldn't a 105, 107 sure. out of a 6mm going faster make sense? It's just there's something in my brain that says, man, 6mm is awfully small for an elk. But at the end of the day, we had dead elk on the ground. So
shot placement.
How does the 300 PRC stack up to the 300 Norma Magnum? Is that, I mean, are they like the same cartridge, or is one faster or slow?
I would simply judge it on case volume. If one of them has more case volume, it's probably going to be faster.
So the Norma has more case volume.
Correct. And now, it's quite possible that the 300 PRC would be more efficient, but you'll never get the velocity you're going to get out of 300 Norma. 300 Norma is huge.
So what's the parent cartridge of a 300 Norma?
I think you've made the 300 Norma and the 300 Norma Mag. Those are two different cartridges.
Okay, I'm sorry. 300 Norma Magnum is what I'm talking about.
So 300 Norma Magnum is the big one. And that's a great long range cartridge. That's a great if you truly intend to engage targets beyond 1,000 and want pinpoint accuracy. So you can shoot those big 230 grain, 215 grain bullets and have 750, 800 BC type
crazy.
Efficiency.
Amazing.
Yeah, yeah. And shoot them, you know, 3,100, 3,000 feet a second. So.
And put all your teeth back in when you're done shooting.
Well, you know, some suppressors knock it down a lot, and with brakes, it's just nothing.
Hmm. Yesterday, I walked into your loading room, and I got to admit, I was like, man, I need a setup like this. Just, I like that you got room, and it's efficient. You can work on your stuff, and
sure.
and it's really, really fun to sit down at the reloader and come up with your, you know, your little homespun load and figure out what shoots, what doesn't. And yesterday, we were in there in Grover, right?
Sure.
Grover was
sure.
in there shooting different cartridges, and one of the things I noticed right away was his cleaning process. And I said, well, what's the process? And he says, well, it's Troy's. Okay. So what is that?
He's a good man.
When you're breaking in a gun, what is your process? Because I hear this all the time from guys. Well, what I do is, you know, I stand up, sit down, turn around three times, and then I, you know, do this, and that makes my gun shoot better, which I'm good with.
Sure.
If you think that it makes you shoot better, then I would keep turning around three times. What is your break-in policy for the barrels that you're shooting there?
So it all has to do with the final application. Is this a precision rifle that's going to be used in tournaments where you need quarter-minute accuracy? Or is this a daily driver that you only need 2 or 3 minute accuracy out of? So if you only need 2 or 3 minute accuracy, you absolutely do not need to break in your barrel. If you need quarter minute accuracy, you might want to break it in, but it's not necessary. It's not absolutely necessary. We do it especially on our test guns because our process has continued to work and it's only 5 or 6 rounds. It's not a 20-round process. But we keep it simple. So we clean it, we fire a shot, we push a solvent down it, we dry patch it out, we fire another shot, we push solvent down it. And one of the other things that people that are really cleaning barrels and paying attention is the fit of patches, the fit of jags and bores. It's not always necessary to have a bore guide. It's awfully tough to tear up your bore, given that jags are made out of bronze or brass. And so it's tough for that to tear up your bore, but it's not a bad idea to have a bore guide. A bore guide could keep some solvent from going down in your trigger group or getting down around your action. But nevertheless, a break-in does not hurt and is a good idea because you're building a precision instrument here. So take the time to treat it like one. And we want the results to be very consistent, and we want these, whether it's a test gun or a competition rifle or whether it's a personal competition rifle, you want that thing to shoot its very best. So if you've got the time, shoot a few shots, clean it, shoot a few shots, clean it. You could come up with your own routine. It's another one of those, don't let anybody talk you out of it if you've proven it to yourself.
And what was the solvent he was using yesterday?
Oh, now, we use several different off-the-counter shelf, you know, over-the-counter products that work just fine. So, you know, I hate to tout any particular one, but there's about 5 out there that if you choose any one of those, they'll do very, very good. So all the major copper solvents work really well. Following up with, so let me, if you don't mind.
No, go ahead.
Just preventive maintenance. So there's kind of, we follow a 3-tiered approach. You have kind of preventive maintenance, which is quick, just lubing, taking care of your bore. You're not spending a long time cleaning. You're just pushing a dry patch down it, a few lubed patches, just to know that your bore is preserved. So you didn't really clean it. You're just taking care of it. And so many times soldiers don't have time to do that before they put something in an arms room. But at some point, somebody takes the time and care, and it could be an NCO that steps in and says, these guns need to be cleaned, and here's the steps we're going to go through. And it might be a thorough cleaning, as you're well aware. Yeah. But just a preservative step, to me, is a lot like people using the convenience of oil change for cars now. There's so many people, there's so many car engines being saved by the convenience of people just driving in and paying, you know, $30-$40 to have their oil changed as opposed to them doing it themselves. But that convenience is there. And that's the same with preventive maintenance on a bore. It's just bore snakes. Are bore snakes bad? Well, they might be bad compared to some precision cleaning techniques, but as a preventive measure, bore snakes a very good way to do it, and it's convenient and it's quick.
One of the other things you said yesterday was that these guys know their bores, so when they go to a competition, they might shoot 3 days and not clean their weapon. Right. They may put lube, they may put a wet patch of lube down, or may not even do that.
Correct. They might just keep their chamber area clean. If it's a bolt gun, they might just lube the lugs. You know, just keep their lugs lubed. Might not even put any on the bolt body. Maybe they're in a dusty environment where they're like, I have the finest lube available, but I put it on it before. I'm in a dusty environment. It seemed to attract more dust, so I'll keep some lube on my lugs and that's it. And maybe on a gas gun, they've learned that, boy, I've got this high-tech lube, dry lube on this, and I don't need any lube at all. Or they need a little. And so, but not clean their bores during certain types of tournaments because not because they didn't have time, but time can be a factor, but because They need it to be spot on every time, and they don't need to be anything to be off. And especially at longer ranges, you talked about cold bore shots. And so cold bore shots, sometimes it's just a flip of a coin. You know, you can have perfect ammo, perfect barrel. You know the condition of your bore, and you've tested this, and it's still a quarter inch off at 100 yards, and you're like, darn, that should have gone in the same hole, but it didn't.
And yeah, and if it's a quarter inch, I think I'd probably be good with that. The guys that are shooting around here, they're not measuring in minutes. They're measuring in partial minutes.
Tenths of an inch, or a minute
of angle. So, sure. Yeah, that's really interesting to see what happens around here. The other thing I was going to bring up is you do all this testing for the military. So people come to you and they say, you know, like I go to Range 37 at Bragg, and they say, yeah, we talked with Troy, and here's the test we're doing. So are you, and I guess this is probably a better question for you, Trey. I mean, that's a big deal. That's a big deal that the military has the capability to call you up and say, we need to find out the difference between this cartridge and this cartridge, or this bullet and that bullet, because we're fixing to make a change with our bolt guns or gas guns or whatever. How do you tie into that process? I mean, how does that work? They come to you and they say, we want to do this test. I mean, you work for AMU. So how does that work?
So, you know, a couple ways. It can be officially driven, you know, top down with a tasking, or because, you know, folks like Troy are just so well known within the community, within the Army, within DOD, that they'll come to him and say, hey, can you help me out? And he'll see if he's got the bandwidth to do so. He asked me if I know of any issues that would prevent us from doing so, and then he goes off and does that. So, you know, it can be official or unofficial taskings or just an ask. And that's essentially, you know, how that process happens. But that's, you know, what you clued in on. You know, we're here for the warfighter. You know, that's the whole reason why we do these things, is so that, you know, through the world-class competitions and through the R&D aspect, you know, we have to feed all the lessons learned, all the fundamentals, all the nuance, the science behind what Troy does, and the fundamentals on the range and the firing line, and we feed that back into the force. And regardless of what color or what type of the force it is, we push it out there. So, and that's one of the things that I think not gets lost, but because of our small size, we're not able to do a large swath, but we can actually pinpoint to the units to ensure that they're finding value in what we get to do every day.
Well, yeah, and I think that, you know, you see a guy out shooting competition, that's great, good, you know, good for him. But this is good for the Army. I mean, having Absolutely. The ability to come in here and have you all test the products and figure out what's what, and your shooters are shooting way more than the average
sure.
soldier is going to be shooting.
Sure.
So you can find, you know, figure out what that is. We also talked about you have done some testing with the M855A1.
Sure.
And that's an interesting cartridge.
Sure.
I was, when I first saw it, I'm like, man, I don't know about this. But when I've seen what it does to flesh, it's pretty impressive. That's a very, very impressive cartridge. So I feel like there was a little politicking going on. People saying, oh, this cartridge sucks. Kind of like they did when 5.56 first came out. Oh, this cartridge sucks. Change the powder so that they don't work. And to this day, people talk about Vietnam and how our guns didn't work, when in fact it had nothing to do with the gun. It had to do with changing powders, and now we got the right stuff going. So M855-1, I think, is a very impressive cartridge.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so, you know, it's another evolution of the M4. And you think of how it originally started, and you think how big the M16A, even the A2 and the A1, how big they were. And look at the evolution and all. And so just like in other technologies of how the convergence and the things we've learned, and to totally be out of ballistics for a second, commo.
Oh, yeah.
Good Lord. You get new commo every, seems like every 2 years, everybody's got to have new commo. It's got to, but the same in ballistics, but in small arms, it's a great time to be in small arms. And so I say that because I'm a ballistics guy. But it's true. And the, and A1 is one of those examples where you have the ARLs and you have the ARDEX, and they are there to direct scientific rigor and approaches to take you to those next steps. And 556 needed it, and that's a good answer. That's a good solution.
Yesterday you showed me some cartridges, some brass that you guys are buying, and you can buy it with, I think, was it 6.5 Creedmoor,
sure,
large and small primer?
Sure.
So that comes with a small primer normally.
So it is normally a large primer cartridge, 6.5 Creedmoor, but now there are several entities selling brass with small primers.
Oh, okay. So why?
It's another one of those that comes from precision shooters that believe that small primers give you a little more efficiency. And so that a calibration effort, a way to gauge efficiency, is with a chronograph. And you're simply looking at your SDs in muzzle velocity. And so it's great to shoot small groups, but it's also, you want to have those low SDs because it is a decent predictor of long-range verticals. So if you have low SDs, you tend to shoot very low verticals out at long range.
Okay, so standard deviation, SD, tell me how that is figured. Because it's not an average.
Correct.
How do you figure that?
So SDs are best used. So now with things, I hate to use brand names, but little small magnetic things that attack to the end of your muzzle that measure muzzle velocity.
Yeah.
These wonderful little chronographs,
yeah,
that are very convenient and available to everybody now. And so I remember when Ken Ayler first announced to the industry that he was going to sell a chronograph to the commercial public, and the industry was like, well, why would you do that? Why do they need to know that? Well, now everybody's got chronographs.
When was that? What year was that?
Back in the 70s. So
wow.
So nevertheless, knowing SDs and knowing that if you only take 5 shots, so a lot of guys do that. Man, I shot 5 shots, my SD is 2. I have a 2-foot SD. Well, you really should look at 30 or 40 or 50 shots to really know what an SD is, because an SD in 5 shots doesn't mean much. But I understand. When you're loading your own and you're paying for your own bullets and your own powder, and you only bought 100, and or you maybe you only bought 200 bullets and you need 100 for the match, you're probably not going to spend too much on load development if you already kind of know, well, it's supposed to be about 40 grains, so I'm going to go out and try 39.8, and I'm going to try 40, and I'm going to try 40.2, and that's all I'm trying because I don't want to waste any more powder and bullets,
yeah,
and they'll only test a few. But SD is a good number and a good predictor to utilize. But as far as how it is derived, the actual formula, I don't know the actual formula.
Okay, so you're letting your equipment do the... Okay. I kind of thought that it was an average, but it's not. Because when you look on your chronograph, you've got SD and you have average.
Right, so you have your average, you have your extreme spread, and spread is very important. So SD will account for spread, but it's almost like mean radius. And so mean radius on targets is an SD. So it finds the middle of a group. So SD in muzzle velocity is a lot like SD in measuring targets. In measuring targets, they call it mean radius. And a mean radius is measured from the center of the group out to every bullet, which is actually a good way to track large numbers. So that was the way Lake City or large manufacturers would track accuracy. They track mean radius. And it is a good way to do it because it's actually, most shooters think in MOA or they just think in straight inches. And that's a good way. But most shooters that walk up and look at a target and they look at the group, they look at the group and they, boy, look, there's four of them in a hole. That one's out, but there's four in a hole. Well, if you had shot that group and measured it for average mean radius, your average mean radius would be extremely small because it's going to measure from the center of that group and it's going to find that, boy, those four that were in one hole, that's under 0.1. So mean radius, when you have, a lot of people have electronic targets now. Now you can buy commercial, you know, electronic targets that'll measure your groups for you and it'll give you mean radius. So that's another standard deviation that's a good metric.
I've always found if I just shoot one round, I have a really good group. That's where I'm
oh, yeah.
Nice.
So one other thing that you did with your barrels, or Grover did yesterday, was he's using a little bit of Flitz to clean the
throat area. Sure. And so that's just an example of a very fine, and I hate to say grit, but it is, and it's close to like 6,000 grit. It's very fine grit. But firm-fitting patches, and so having patches that fit firm, and so when you're paying attention to cleaning weapons, having a jag and the fit of the patch to the jag in the bore is very important, and knowing that, that feels rather loose. Well, if you're just mopping the bore and trying to get something wet down it, that's okay. But when you're trying to polish just that first inch and a half, the patch needs to fit firm. Have a little bit of that, whether it's JB, whether it's IOSO paste, whether it's any of these fine grit things. Having the smooth throat, especially when you start, is an enhancer to accuracy. It's a very good idea.
So how often should the average shooter do that to the throat of their weapon?
Boy, if you don't see any degradation in accuracy, so if your gun's still shooting to you, whatever your standard is, and if your standard is, boy, it's got to shoot quarter inch. It's not shooting quarter inch, I just can't win. Or if you're a pie plate type guy, boy, I've got a 9-inch pie plate, and I'm always inside a 9-inch pie plate, well, then you're meeting your standard. However, if it begins to degrade, then freshening the throat, so to speak, freshening it by doing a little polish. And this might be something that's not done until 1,200 rounds in some calibers. But in some calibers, it might be worthy of making a small, which might only be 10 passes. It's just minor. I mean, you've all polished things on a surface that you can see and seen how just a few passes with a polish can make an abrupt change to the surface texture. So it's worthy to... So plenty of times you're using bore solvents that just aren't getting rid of carbon at all. You're getting rid of copper, but you don't remove carbon. And carbon is the killer of accuracy. So you need to get the carbon out.
So carbon is more important than copper?
Well, copper and steel barrels have been getting along for a long time. And they'll continue to do that. So having bad copper fouling can be a deterrent, but having bad fouling from too much carbon can cause pressure spikes,
so
pressure increased.
Well, the good thing, though, is can't you cut carbon with a less aggressive solvent?
Oh, no question. So there are definitely some soaks. So there are some they're soap-like. So they're not actually solvents. They're more soap-like. And if you soak them with those soap-like products, it will loosen it so that you can remove it.
Yep. So when you're cleaning those barrels and you're breaking, you're getting all of the green out, or you're getting just was he using a copper solvent yesterday, right?
Correct. And so he pushes them out till they're clean.
Okay.
Yeah.
So keep wet and let it sit and see if you get any green out. And those were coming out like bright blue yesterday.
Oh yeah, at first, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah. And that's fine. That's fine.
Oh, my goodness. Trey, what do you think? You got somebody that cleans your guns for you, right? Isn't that how it is?
I just don't clean them. How about that?
If those are the fun guns.
Right. If it's not an issue, you know, if you don't worry about it, it's not an issue.
Those are
the
fun guns.
See, you're seeing just a little snapshot of what I get to deal with every day. Because every day it's like Disneyland. I come in here and I listen to these smart folks, and they try to tell me. They try to tell me what they're doing, and I'm interested. I just can't keep up. And so I'm like, all right, hey, just give me about 15 minutes of it, and then I'll see you tomorrow. We'll pick back up. Because this is absolutely like a PhD-level instruction that I'm getting.
So all of the guns, whether it's an action pistol or it's a PRS gun or a service rifle, they're all built downstairs from your office.
Yes, yes. They are all built and maintained by our folks.
Yeah, yesterday they whipped out a bag of guns, and there was like five identical race guns, IPSC 38 Super. I mean, they were all absolutely the same. I was like, wow.
Yep. Yep. And we do that, and that's probably one shooter's, because he'll have that and he'll alternate, you know, a particular pistol or a rifle, but they all have redundancy, and they do alternate those just in the event that something goes down during a competition or whatnot. He's got the ability to still stay in the fight.
What is the how has PRS affected y'all here at AMU?
So just like you mentioned Merle Eddington years ago in action shooting. So when AMU took on the action shooting team, and then that was more IDPA, IPSC type stuff, and then it evolved into three gun, also included three gun. And then PRS is just one more competitive venue that we can showcase these guys' skill sets, because they're, you know, they're expected to win. It's the win mission. And you need extremely good kit. You need extremely good people that understand it. Boy, AMU touches so much.
That's about the closest, I mean, from a sniper's perspective.
True.
That's probably the closest competition that's ever come around that reflects what a sniper would do on the battlefield.
True.
Because it's all non-standard positions. Now, they do have some rules on calibers, though, right?
So they have a speed limit and they have a caliber limit. But usually they don't necessarily have a caliber limit. They just tell you you can't go over well, usually it's 338. They usually don't let you shoot bigger than 338.
You can shoot a 6mm Creedmoor.
You can.
Okay.
Cannot shoot faster than 3150. Yep.
And what is the Army Marksmanship unit right now? What is their weapon of choice for caliber for PRS?
Know your enemy. So to be competitive in that sport, there's only two bore diameters, and it's 6mm and 6.5. And we currently use 6mm because that is what has won the tournament the most. And so we have several cartridges in the 6mm mid-case family, 6XC, 6 Creedmoor, that will accomplish what we need.
What's the Dasher? What is that?
So Dasher is 6BR that's been blown out, so it's ACLI improved 6BR.
Okay.
So basically they took a 6BR and blew it out.
Little short cartridge.
And it's another one of those that was just an evolution from, well, we've got this great piece of brass, but we need more volume. So what predicated that was they wanted a little more velocity than 6BR was capable of shooting a 105 grain bullet. Because the 105 grain bullet had the kind of the minimum BC that would give you the effects you wanted in PRS.
So what weight guns are they shooting?
So there are people that take the approach of, I want the lightest weapon. I just want a light gun. So there are those that shoot 12-pound guns, which that would be ridiculously light. So most of them weigh between 15 and 18.
And then I think we were talking yesterday, one of your service rifle gals, she shoots like an 18-pound M16
sure. Right.
Yes.
Across the course.
Yes.
And she'll
hold that up in that position
and have a conversation
with you for 5 or 10 minutes and not move.
And that's the necessity of that sport. So to be competitive in that sport and to kill recoil in a game that you cannot have a muzzle break, and that's...
You're talking about service rifle.
Service rifle.
Yeah.
In that particular sport, and I have shot that. And so I've competed in President's 100 and all the different things. But the evolution of that sport is when you fire, you want it to return back to target immediately. So it's boom, boom, it comes right back.
Yeah.
Well, to achieve that and to not have any recoil mitigating device, the only other option is add weight to the weapon. So that's what they've done. And so they get comfortable with a particular weight and balance, and there they are.
That's probably the best learning I ever did as a sniper was to go to Camp Perry.
You bet. Good fundamentals.
Yeah, we did a train up at Camp Butner. We shot nice. There for a week, and then we headed to Camp Perry. And I wish I – maybe someday I'll go back. I don't know. But I learned more in that train up and then going there and competing every day. And the only thing I didn't like was that President's 100 is the first match. But it's the first match for everybody. So, of course, I learned a lot over that next week of shooting all the other matches. And I thought, man, if I would have had this score during President's 100, well, that's the case with everybody. So it's I would highly recommend anybody to get into any competition they can because it just makes you better all around, whether it's conventional pistol or shooting PRS or whatever it might be. So,
And speaking of the national matches, so one thing that I didn't know as I came on board here is that, you know, AMU is congressionally mandated to provide small arms firing schools in conjunction with the national matches. So we'll go up there, and they can be DOD or civilian, but that is, you know, based on U.S. Code 32, we provide instruction during the national matches. So anybody, as you're welcoming other folks to come out, yeah, please do. You can get 3 or 4 days of training through, you know, both pistol and rifle from the AMU.
It's an unbelievable venue for that. Wait a minute. We just have this in off the newsreel here. In 2013, we have the winner of the President's 100 matches sitting here with us today.
Oh, is that right? Let's see. It's not me.
And it's not me.
Nice.
Yeah, so that was a fun day on the range.
So you know nice. Guys like, doggone it, Reichenberg, Eric.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so Eric was one of our guys
Neat.
That had been shot with y'all.
Yep.
And unbelievable shooter. And I'm trying to remember the other guy who had won the matches had been the national champ. He also worked in our arms room. And what blew my mind was you go to the arms room and you're talking to these dudes.
Yep.
And they're in their blue work uniform, their Dickies stuff, and they're just like, you know, oh yeah, work on your gun, and they're not condescending. Eric is just salt of the earth. And I wish I could remember this other guy's name. And then it became time to go down range and have them come and see how our M14s were shooting because we hadn't made the transition. And they would say, let me see your rifle for a second. And they would, offhand, 200 yards, and they're knocking the center out of it. And you're going, who the heck is this guy? They had been at that top level and then had left that to come and work in our arms room. Just amazing.
Wow.
Amazing guys. Eric and I want to see the other guy's name is Greg, but I might be wrong there. I'm sure you know Eric, so I'm sure you know the other fellow too, but great dude. So preparing for that match.
Sure.
What kind of preparation did it take for you to 2013? That wasn't that long ago.
That wasn't. So it's like any endeavor or any competitive endeavor, you've got to train up where you what am I weak at? Well, do I need to improve my offhand? So I had always been an offhand shooter. So I had grown up shooting offhand. So offhand was very natural for me. So I needed to work on rapid fire, of all things, and was not a very good rapid fire shooter and got better at it. So
going back to the course, you shoot 200 offhand, 200 rapid fire sitting,
yep,
300 rapid fire prone.
Now, in the P100, it's only... It's only 30 shots, and you shoot 10 shots standing at 200, and then you back up and shoot 10 shots rapid fire at 300 yards. Then you
kneeling
back up
or sitting?
Prone, rapid fire prone.
I mean, I'm prone. Yeah, okay, yeah.
And they start standing, and you drop down into prone and shoot your 10 shots in a minute. Have to make a mag change. So you shoot 8 rounds, then 2 rounds, or 2 and 8. At 600 yard line, you shoot 10 shots, slow fire, and it's pull and mark. The old KD range, same old pull and mark.
There's no spotters though, and
no sighters.
No sighters
match. So every round counts. Yep. That's right. So you're always wanting that first round to be there. Yeah, I'll never forget my scorekeeper when I shot my last shot. He was an older gentleman, and he said, "Well, that's a really good score." And I said, "Well, thank you, sir." And so I was packing my gear up, and there was a shoot-off. So the top 20 or 25 go and shoot a 10-shot shoot-off. And he goes, "My son has the internet on his phone. Hold on." And he brings the son over. He goes, "You're number one in the shoot-off." And I said, "Well, I guess I better get over there then."
That's awesome.
So that was fun. It was fun. And yeah.
Yeah, so when you do that, are you a representative of AMU?
No, just a hobby. Just, you know, it's professional development. You need to keep abreast of these things.
The thing that I did not know, because I've been an IPSC shooter and a three-gun shooter, which is fun, don't get me wrong. It is a blast to do that shooting. But when I went to Camp Perry, I was down pulling pits with a guy that was a Korean War vet.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
And I'm looking at this old dude. He can barely get around. And I'm thinking, well, I guess I'm going to be pulling all the pits today when this guy's sitting on his cooler over there. And sure enough, first round, and he was up, had marked it, and was back down before I even thought about getting up and moving. And I ended up becoming buddies with him and his other buddies and, you know, listening to all their stories. And it was really good. As an American kid, because I was still pretty young at that time, going up there and meeting these guys, it was just awesome to meet.
Sure.
You meet such great people at those matches.
Oh, and then AMU touches so many diverse groups because of the different types of shooting disciplines, like you mentioned earlier, in your IPSC, IDPA type stuff. There's a certain type of shooter, and you said shotgun. Shotgun is kind of a social event, maybe even a more elite event. But nevertheless, you touch all these diverse groups, and you also touch diverse age groups.
Yeah.
And so, like you say, a Korean War vet. I can remember so many fantastic conversations with older gentlemen that I would never have talked to had I not gone to some of these events. And you get a little downtime, and you get to hear their side, hear their story. And I never forget a gentleman, a farmer from Iowa, had never been to the national championship. And he said, "I have wanted to come here for 50 years.
Yeah, that's cool.
He said, "And I'm here this year, and it's the only year I'm going to do it." He said, "But I'm going to shoot every single event."
Yeah,
and he
nice.
Did.
Yeah.
He shot every, because I noticed, gee, he's over there, he's shooting the 30 carbine event. Oh, he's over here shooting the P100. Oh, he's shooting the Garand match. He's shooting everything.
Yeah.
But it was one of those things. He was a farmer. He didn't have time, but he shot on his farm. And he prepared, and he got ready for nationals. And so it's just another one, and veterans. So veterans at especially service rifle style events. It's incredible, the stories I've heard.
I remember one of the things we did. We were there with our Army buddies, and then we had, so our sniper troop, we had, you know, probably 15 guys there shooting. And then my buddy was there as a civilian, him and his buddy. And I thought, there's really one way to get him off the game. So I went to their hotel and went to the front, and I said, "Can I get a wake-up call at 2, because I got to get out of here early." At 2:02. And I said, "You know what? And I'm a heavy sleeper, so if I get up then, could I get another one at 3?
Nice.
So,
oh, no.
So,
no.
The next day we show up on the range, And I mean, actually, somebody else made him do this. It wasn't me. I'm not the one that did this. Sure. It was somebody else.
Sure.
So the next day we show up on the range and I go, Jim, how's it going, man? He's like, man, the stupid front desk called us at 02. And I was like, really? What's that about? Yeah, then I cussed him out and they called me back at 3 o'clock in the morning again. I was like, okay. Oh, I just laughed and laughed, but they looked terrible that day. So, so what's next, Trey? What's next on the agenda for you here at AMU? What do you got cooking?
Next on the agenda, let's see. So I'm flying out tonight, going back to Fort Knox. That's where our higher headquarters is right now. But really, as far as AMU is concerned, majority of the teams, minus Action Shooting, are on their... They just returned from their shooting season. So what they're doing is recouping, and next week they'll start training up for the next season. So they don't have a lot of downtime at all. And about November is when the Action Shooting folks will start winding down for them.
But when are the national matches? When are the national matches at Camp Barry?
They're in the, what is it, June time frame.
Roger.
The other thing about AMU, which never winds down, is that ITG folks, the instructor training group folks that we have, and those guys are always busy, always on TDY. In fact, they leave tomorrow to go to Fort Riley. And those are that's our interface, providing that value back to the warfighter, and it's through those guys. And they don't run very deep. There's about 10 of them. And essentially, they're responsible for providing POIs and the training methodologies that work for units either out the door, about to deploy, or just units that are in their unit collective training cycle that they need to hone in and when I that, you know they've identified marksmanship.
They're working mostly though with basic rifle marksmanship or advanced rifle marksmanship. Are they doing any tactical shooting with them, or is it?
They don't teach tactics, but what they'll do, if you talk about tactics, they'll have your barricade out there. They'll talk different firing positions, different techniques to transition from one gun to the next. Things to think about when that. But they do not. They don't brush the subject of tactics.
But you've drawn a lot of those guys from the Rangers.
Yes. So the majority of them come from the Ranger Regiment. And I think that group is only about 5 years old. Not the individuals, but the group itself. And the first tranche of folks that we got was from the Rangers. So we're definitely capitalizing on their combat experience, their tenure, and their maturity level. And then couple that with the fundamentals that they're pulling from the competitions and the shooters here, that's the product that the end user gets.
So, believe it or not, we've been yakking for about an hour and a half.
I don't believe it.
Troy, what else you got? What else you got on your list? Anything?
Great time to be in small arms.
Yeah, it really is. So I'm going to read something to you here real quick. You know all this information, but guys like Trey and I may not.
Oh, boy.
So in 1894, the 6.5 by 55 Swedish Mauser came around. That was a 140-grain bullet at 2,540 feet per second. That's really impressive. I mean, it really is for not even the,
Sure.
Not even 1900 yet. 1900, there's a 6.5 by 54 Mannlicher Schonauer, 140 grain. They had to keep up, I guess, with the Swedes. 1958, so took 58 years to get the 264 Winchester. 1966, the 6.5 Remington Magnum. Now, these are all relatively big cartridges, and then we start to shrink it down. 1997 was a 260 Remington, 140 grain bullet at 2725. 1999, 6.5, 284, Norma.
And we've shot a lot of them.
That is a smoking cartridge. 2,900 feet per second. What was the one you mentioned, the 6.5 47?
6.5 by 47.
Tell me about that cartridge.
So like you mentioned, better quality brass and more availability of brass from different sources. So Lapua created a 6.5 by 47, and I actually don't know the year of introduction, but okay. It's been one of my favorites for years.
And then 2003, the 6.5 Grendel. Now, you guys have done a lot with that as well, right, in the three-gun community?
We have loaded that, and that is an effective cartridge.
But that's not the...
Not enough volume.
Okay. So are the guys still using that at all for the three-gun, or what are they using mostly?
5.56.
Okay, so back to the 5.56. 2007, 6.5 Creedmoor. 2013, 26 Nosler, which is another large cartridge. 6.5 300 Weatherby Magnum, that's a monster. And then 2017, the 6.5 PRC. So we had a dead spot in there of 58 years, but then we got back on the... Well, then we had a dead spot of 30 years between 6.5 Remington Magnum to 260 Remington.
Sure.
I'm really excited to see what happens. And what I'm really excited about is now that I've got you here in person, I can get your phone number. So when I got these stupid questions, I can call you up because okay. I hear so much. It's nice to hear from somebody that's actually been on the range and shot the cartridges and knows what they're talking about, because in our community, you don't know what you don't know because there's sure. so much stuff going on.
Sure.
This new HBN, that's something I've kind of been out of the sniper community for a while. That's something new to me. The 6.5 PRC and 300 PRC, I don't really know much about them. The 300 Norma Magnum and the 338, know a little bit about that. Machine guns in 338 Norma Magnum, that's kind of cool.
Sure.
Yeah.
And for those of you out there that don't kind of understand where we're going with this, so, and Troy, you jump in if I say something that's incorrect here ballistically, okay? So you have a 300 Winchester Magnum. Okay, let me back up. You have a 7.62 cartridge, and your drops are close at the close yard lines with 5.56. They're not radically different.
Sure, inside of 300.
Inside of 300 yards. Get beyond 300 yards, okay, the military's went to 300 Magnum. Now, 300 Winchester Magnum, now we have a 6.5 Creedmoor, a 260, that actually shoots flatter and cuts the wind better than a 300 Winchester Magnum. True statement, right?
True statement.
Then we go up to 338 Lapua, and now we have 300 Norma Magnum that will actually shoot flatter and cut the wind better than a 338 Lapua.
Correct.
Still a true statement, right?
Correct.
Now we continue out there. We have a 50 caliber. We just call it 50 cal. What is the right terminology for that cartridge?
50 BMG.
50 BMG, okay. 50 so 50 BMG and the 338 Norma Magnum will actually outperform that wind and drop.
In wind and drop.
Okay, wind and drop, but yeah. not payload on
not,
the target.
Not kinetic energy.
Yeah, 700, what are those bullets, 700 grains?
Correct, they can be that
yeah.
much, that's right.
So the interesting thing about that, and this is me saying this, nobody in the Army, but to see a machine gun in a caliber that's not 7.62, that's amazing. I mean, I really never thought that I would see that in my lifetime, that we would change machine gun calibers, but now we may. I don't know what exists yet. I know that there's a lot of manufacturers that are heavily going after some crazy calibers and doing some wonky stuff, and that's because the military has asked. The next thing up is going to be the carbine. What's going to happen next in the carbine? So it's exciting. I mean, I think that we've definitely stepped forward with the pistols in the military, definitely with the long guns, with the bolt guns and things like that. Now we're going to see machine guns. Heavy machine guns, light machine guns. Imagine that if you could carry a weapon onto the battlefield that would give you similar trajectory to the 50, but you could carry it at the squad level or the platoon level. Carry it, not like roll it out on a vehicle. So, right. Yeah, exciting time. It's
absolutely.
It's awesome. I can't wait to see what you guys got cooking there. And, yeah, all my buddies in the industry, they always have something up their sleeve, but I think that you guys are where the rubber meets the road, so keep doing what y'all are doing, and thank you for taking the time to sit down with us. You got any final comments there, Trey? Are you good?
No, not at all. I'm glad you came to visit us. Thank you. And I guess I won't see you again for another 3 or 4 years, right? So that's how it happens.
Yeah, so here's folks, here's how it goes. The way Trey likes to do it is he will not come visit me.
Right.
He makes me come visit him. So he comes into Nashville, never tells me, and then anyway. No, thanks, Troy.
It's
I appreciate you taking the time. And you've been at AMU now how long?
32 years.
32 years. So you're almost getting it figured out. I hope that you somehow can get a T in that block one of these days.
I have to throw my wife in. We've also been married for 32 years.
Nice.
That's awesome.
Got to include family.
Nice. That's awesome. Nice. All right. Well, thank you so much. And, folks, thanks for joining us. If you would, go on and leave a 5-star rating for us. We could really use that. Leave us some comments there as well. If you have comments to add to us. Oh, you know what? I actually have to read one. Now that I hate to do this at the very end. I should have done this at the beginning. But I'm going to read a comment that one of our customers sent us here. So let's see. All right, so we had a few guys on our podcast that we talked about. What's the difference between a hillbilly, a country boy, and a redneck? And this is what my buddy Greg from it says, in the heart of the Appalachian Mountains in Richlands, Virginia. He says, you've asked a couple of guests about the difference between a hillbilly and a country boy. Being a hillbilly by birth, raised in a coal camp in southwestern Virginia, I would have to say a few things jump out at me immediately. First, a hillbilly has to be from the mountains, probably the southern Appalachians. A country boy could be from almost anywhere. Secondly, a true hillbilly will have a moonshiner in their family tree. Also, a hillbilly will have that unique Appalachian dialect. You know it when you hear it. He says he watched a program on Discovery that examined the Appalachian dialect, and the linguistic experts concluded that the Appalachian dialect was closer to the King's English than any other spoken in the U.S.
Interesting.
So I had a guy up at SIG Academy this week when we were out there, and he said that one of the things about the hillbillies, Billy came from, that's what they call the English. So if you were a Billy, that was because you were English. They were in the mountains, so they became hillbillies. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but what this guy says, he's one of them, so it's got to be a true statement there. So anyway, please send us emails like that. We love to hear from you folks. It's caused me to buy a lot of books that I'm now trying to plow through there. We love the stuff that you talk about, history. I don't know, is there any other history we need to cover on this building before we go? I think we kind of hit that, right?
I think we took care of it.
We did.
All right, so send us an email, give us a 5-star rating, and last but not least, God bless America.
Amen.